I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation. Today, it's with a dear friend of the late Daniel Pearl. She started a college course to try to find out who killed him. But first, we have news from the Supreme Court, which today, for the first time ever, stepped into the global warming debate, forcing the Bush administration to take another look at regulating greenhouse gases. The Environmental Protection Agency had argued that it didn't have the authority to regulate carbon emissions from new trucks and cars. In addition, the agency said there wasn't enough scientific evidence connecting carbon emissions to global warming. Well, the court ruled that the EPA does have that authority and must re-examine the science. For more, we go to veteran Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com. Lyle, first of all, who brought this case and why?
This was brought, Robin, originally by 12 states. The leading state was Massachusetts, arguing that the EPA refusal to regulate greenhouse gases was a threat to their own environmental situation, and that Congress had made clear under the Clean Air Act that it wanted those emissions to be regulated.
Well, what was the EPA arguing in response to that claim?
Well, EPA claimed that the law as written by Congress did not mandate that it actually step into the controversy over global warming. But even if the law should be read that Congress did want them to look at it, they had examined the scientific evidence suggesting a link between these gases and the warming up of the globe and found a lack of a certainty that there was any such link. Well, the court today says you do have the authority. It's clear that the law applies to any air pollutant, and carbon dioxide is certainly one of those. And in addition to that, not only do you have the authority, you must use it unless you are able to show us that there is absolutely no link between the emission of these exhaust fumes containing carbon dioxide and the warming up of the globe.
Well, what is the next step then, Lyle? Does the EPA have to go back to the Supreme Court with proof, for instance, that greenhouse gases don't exist?
I presume that it will go back to EPA and they will conduct some kind of a case in which they will look again at the scientific evidence. At this point, the court does not tell them what they need to find when they make this new look. But if EPA again concludes that it's not going to regulate, you can be sure that the states and cities and the environmental groups will be right back in court and be on its way back up to the Supreme Court once more.
Well, in the world scientific community, the preponderance of scientists have said that carbon emissions do lead to global warming. I mean, it wouldn't seem as if the EPA at this stage of the game would be able to argue against it.
Well, the states and cities and environmental groups are certainly absolutely persuaded that the scientific evidence all runs their way. And, in fact, they have made that loud and clear to the Supreme Court. And at least that argument prevailed as a legal matter today. Now it's up to the EPA. And this process, by the way, Robin, is not going to unfold quickly. It's going to take some time and, as a matter of fact, may stretch on into the next presidential administration.
Well, Lyle, it sounds as if the EPA today lost on its one stance that it doesn't have the authority to regulate carbon emissions. But now it seems as if, I mean, are we set up to see the EPA coming back and perhaps arguing whether or not greenhouse gases and global warming exists at the Supreme Court level?
Well, it's clear that the court has left it open to the EPA to take a new look and to draw whatever conclusions EPA is inclined to draw. One could read between the lines, however, and suggest that the court seems to be persuaded at this point that the scientific evidence is already there. But we'll have to wait to see if EPA agrees with that. And if it doesn't, then, of course, there'll be a whole new round in the courts, and that will obviously return to the Supreme Court.
If the EPA agrees that carbon emissions lead to global warming, they would have to regulate that. Does that mean they'd have to put caps on carbon emissions?
Yes. One of the remedies would be to put limits on automobile exhausts. And the EPA, by the way, one of its arguments was, well, we can't regulate auto exhaust. That's something for the Department of Transportation to do. But the Supreme Court today addressed that argument directly and said, just because another agency of the government has its own responsibilities doesn't mean that EPA can shirk its duties under the Clean Air Act.
Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com reporting on the Supreme Court decision today that the EPA has the authority to regulate carbon emissions and must use that authority unless it can determine that greenhouse gases do not endanger the environment. Lyle, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
When the news came out last month that accused terrorist Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had confessed to personally beheading Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl 5 years ago, he didn't convince Pearl's wife, Marianne, or Danny's parents. And Asra Nomani wasn't impressed either. She is the Wall Street Journal reporter and friend of Daniel Pearl, who spent the weeks in between his capture and death in 2002 trying, with Danny's wife, to find out where Danny was. Well, since then, she's been trying to find out who killed him. She's launched what she calls the Danny Project, an investigative journalism class at Georgetown University. And Asra joins us from the studios of WVAQ in Morgantown, West Virginia. Asra, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much.
I want to talk about that class, but first, you know, why don't you think Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or KSM as he's called, he's also called the 9/11 mastermind, why don't you think he personally killed Daniel Pearl?
Well, you know, since the first word came out, it was 2 years ago that he had confessed in a holding cell somewhere in the Middle East after the CIA and Pakistani intelligence picked him up. I called around to the investigators that had worked in the field with Marianne and me trying to find Danny, and none of them had heard any kind of convincing evidence that linked Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to Danny's death. This confession was one that you wouldn't, or I could have said, had we just watched the video of Danny being slain. He gives us no new evidence that proves that he was there. There's no telling sign. The person is identified only by their feet and their hands. And there's been word that the U.S. has done some, you know, hand analysis, but none of the investigators nor the family have been given any of that evidence linking Khalid Sheikh to the video.
You know, and you told us something very interesting. You mentioned, yes, 2 years ago when your former newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, first reported that KSM had confessed to this beheading. Condoleezza Rice at the time called Marianne Pearl. You tell us that this time around, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez personally called Marianne just before the confession was made public. And what did he tell her?
Well, he told her that this confession was going to come out, that it was going to be released, and Marianne, like any person, asked, what evidence do you have? And he said, we have further evidence, and she asked what it was, and he said that he couldn't provide it. And so, again, you know, this just raises all sorts of red flags, because if you're calling the family and you're telling them that you know that this is the case and you expect them to sort of just roll over and say, okay, we believe you, that's insulting the intelligence of just about everybody, I think, because we're in a day and age now where we need credible proof. And so we haven't seen any of that yet. People have said that it's related to his hands in the video.
People have said that perhaps what Gonzalez was referring to was related to KSM's hands.
Right.
Well, why wouldn't they release that?
I would think so. You know, it's not like it's revealing the location of Osama bin Laden or something like that. So that's what is at play here. And part of what I want to try to do in this project, too, is look at the politics, you know, that have surrounded Danny's death since word came out that he had been murdered. You know, the judicial system in Pakistan has had its own politics. The investigation has had its politics. At the end of the day, Danny's dead. So I think for a lot of people, they don't want this investigation or the evidence related to it to interfere with the delicate politics between America and Pakistan. And the journalist in me just wants to know why.
Well, tell us more about this class. I want to get to the questions that remain for you about the death of your friend, but tell us about this project. I understand you're modeling it on some of the innocence projects that look for DNA evidence in the case of death row inmates. What do you hope to do with the class?
Well, it's really exciting because, you know, since I left Karachi, it's just dogged me, you know, this question of what happened to Danny, who killed him, why did they kill him, and not just as a whodunit, but really as a effort to try to understand what happened here where these cultures intersected and a group of people decided that this man was not innocent as a journalist, and they didn't understand what he was doing. To me, his murder reveals a lot about the problematic relationship, too, between Muslims and the media, the defined by distrust from moderates to the extremists. And we need to figure out what's going on there if we really want to be able to bridge this misunderstanding.
Well, you know, remind us, first of all, many of us have read Marion Pearl's excellent book about this terrible time that you all went through. But remind us, what did his hostage takers, what did they say were the issues when they were holding him?
Well, first they called Danny a spy for the CIA, and then they called him a spy for Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, because he had been identified in the Pakistani press as Jewish. And so what I really want to try to figure out here is why even those, you know, identity markers in Danny were justification for his murder. What is it about being an American, being Jewish, having links to Israel that justify a person's murder? I mean, a lot of us can sit around a dining table and think about it, but I want to also just report it out. And so that's what's so exciting about this project is we're going to have 10 students, 5 undergrads, 5 grad students. Georgetown's starting a new master's program in journalism.
Well, what do you plan to do? Are you going to go to Pakistan with these kids? It's a very dangerous inquiry you're making.
It is. You know, at the end of the day, we have to be honest about the fact that there was a murder here, right? The people who were involved were playing a very high-stakes game. Danny lost his life, and I don't take any of that lightly. And I don't want to traumatize the students, for one thing. I want to help them navigate this world of investigative reporting. And I love those Jesuits because they want to show that, you know, the investigation and spirit of critical thinking that is part of academia doesn't stop at the walls of academia, but spill out into the streets.
Azra Nomani, this fall she's going to begin a stint as a visiting professor at Georgetown University, teaching a journalism course called The Pearl Project, to try to find out who killed her friend and former Wall Street Journal colleague Daniel Pearl.
We invite tips from anyone at pearlproject@georgetown.edu. Any ideas that folks have?
Are you going to advertise that in Pakistan?
Yes, absolutely, because I expect that I'm going to get an email from some cyber cafe in the northwest frontier with ideas, because I know that in Pakistan there are great people of conscience who also would like the truth to come out.
That's Azra Nomani. For more information, by the way, on that tip line of the Daniel Pearl Project, go to our website, here-now.org. And Azra will be back in a moment to tell us more about what Daniel Pearl was investigating when he was killed. Later on Here and Now, quick note, we'll look at the standoff between Iran and Britain. We'll have a report from Tehran on the new softer language being used by both sides today, as well as some insight into what's going on behind the scenes in this crisis over the captured British sailors. That's later. More with Azra Nomani after a quick break. Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Azra Nomani, a friend and former colleague of slain journalist Daniel Pearl. Azra spent 5 weeks after Pearl was kidnapped in 2002 with Pearl's wife, Marianne, both of them trying to find him before he was killed. Last month, the U.S. military released a confession from accused terrorist Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, also known as KSM, in which he says he personally beheaded Pearl. Azra doesn't believe it. She's begun what she calls the Danny Project, an investigative journalism class this fall at Georgetown University, to find out who killed her friend. Azra, you've told us about some of the questions you want your students to ask. Now, there's a lot of speculation about some of the answers that are coming up. So, for instance, what did Danny have that his hostage takers and then killers might have thought was dangerous to them? What kind of evidence did he have?
You know, during those 5 weeks, I went through every single email that Danny sent out before he was kidnapped. And another book by Bernard-Henri Lévy, this French philosopher, mm-hmm. has been the spark for a lot of the speculation. He suggested that Danny had links between Al-Qaeda, Pakistan, and nuclear secrets, that he knew about, you know, the intersection of the Pakistani intelligence and Al-Qaeda.
And that, in fact, KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, might have been Pakistani intelligence.
Right, right. And, you know, at the end of the day, Danny, like every journalist, had just a little tip that day. He had an idea of who Richard Reed's handler might have been in Pakistan.
Richard Reed, the shoe bomber.
Right. And Danny was really excited that afternoon because he thought that he could track down who that man was. And as you know, that's a huge lead.
Because, he had the email address, which,
right.
You know, which is a lead, but it's really...
It's not
something you'd kill someone over.
Right. And so I think that, and you know, Danny had done a big story before about the currency trading that had been used to finance a lot of Al-Qaeda operations. He had done pieces on smuggling operations that also were funding the Taliban. So definitely, if somebody wanted to have a conspiracy theory, they could have thought that Danny had a lot of stuff in his notebook, and he was an amazing journalist. But like the best journalists of our world, he had little bits of information that he was trying to piece together. He didn't have links between the Muslim mafia and Al-Qaeda. And in that, that's one important area that I want to be able to spell out for the world in terms of trying to answer why they killed Danny. Because I think a lot of it was their own imagination about what he knew.
Maybe inflating what he
did
know. I just want to ask you, you mentioned Bernard Lévy, the Frenchman, and who said that KSM was a Pakistani intelligence officer. Do you believe that?
I don't know, and that's one of the things that I really want to find out.
Well, another question is, isn't somebody already in jail in Pakistan, sentenced to death for kidnapping Daniel Pearl? He's a British-educated man named Omar Sheikh. He is in jail.
Right. And he's been arrested and convicted for the kidnapping and murder of Danny. But what we'd like to establish is whether he was actually involved in the murder, which all the evidence suggests that he wasn't. And what were his links with Pakistani intelligence?
Yeah, you know, your whole thing, you've made the question of, you know, who killed Daniel Pearl and why, the centerpiece of your life, starting this project. I mean, some would say, why ask why? You know, these must have been just some despicable people who wanted to kill a Jewish man, an American, a journalist, you know, for pure hate. They may just be, you know, punks, lowlifes, without, you know, without attachment to some bigger issue. And why, you know, why ask why? What would you say to that?
Well, if we find out that it was just a series of very unfortunate circumstances, that'll be just fine. We don't need to find a conspiracy, you know. Sometimes the story is much more ordinary than even anyone can imagine. But I know that the truth frees us in many ways, because I think that with the truth, you can actually move forward to have reconciliation, forgiveness, understanding. And I know in my heart at the end of the day that Danny wouldn't have let it go if it had happened to any one of his friends. And so I am inspired, you know, in part by his spirit.
I'm wondering if Marianne feels the same way. We've had Marianne on the program quite a bit. And after Khalid Sheikh Mohammed made his confession, or some would say claim, of killing her husband Daniel, she wrote, "I see his motives in saying this, whether he carried it out or not. He's just trying to drag me into, you know, the world of disgust and horror, and I'm not going to do it. I'm going to resist by celebrating values of humanism and dignity." It sounds as if she is not as pulled as you are down this road.
Yeah, I think that for her, it's, you know, obviously a personal journey that she has to really make a priority as the mother to Danny's baby also. And I know that she wants this project to happen. We have talked about it, you know, since the days that we left Karachi, and she supports it from her heart. Although she understands for herself, has come to feel that, you know, she's got to proceed and persevere on a parallel path.
Meantime, are you Muslim?
I am.
How much for you is this a personal quest to, as you said, not just find out who Danny's killer is, but what's going on in the minds of the Muslims who killed him?
Yeah, that's a great question, Robin, because, you know, before Danny was killed, I was one part of the silent moderate majority in our Muslim world. And so I want to really try to figure out how to lift the mistrust and the skepticism on all sides about the other.
It sounds like call Muslims on what it sounds like you're saying is, you know, this violent strain. Just call it what it is when you see it. You know, maybe to understand it, but not excuse it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I lost my friend. I think that if we understand things, it doesn't mean that we say that it's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, but hopefully what we can do is move our world forward.
Azra Nomani, this fall she's going to begin a stint as a visiting professor at Georgetown University, teaching a journalism course called The Pearl Project, to try to find out who killed her friend and former Wall Street Journal colleague Daniel Pearl. Azra, thanks and best to you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Venezuela's ambassador to the U.S. is going to speak to us about the rocky relationship between Presidents Bush and Chavez. And folk icon David Bromberg is back with his first CD in 26 years, asking fans to try me one more time. That's tomorrow. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We have an update on that standoff between Iran and Britain. Officials in Britain say they've agreed to discuss with Iran ways to prevent future disputes in the Persian Gulf. And Iran has apparently agreed not to broadcast any more footage of those captured British crew members. Meanwhile, questions have been raised about the role of Iran's elite Revolutionary Guard, whose naval forces snatched the British sailors and Marines more than a week ago. Borzu Daragahi is Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us from Tehran. And Borzu, first of all, to those statements from Britain and Iran, are we seeing a shift in the crisis?
Well, I think there's been stuff going on behind the scenes constantly. I know for a fact that the British diplomats here have been in near daily contact with their Iranian counterparts. It's a very complicated and fluid situation internally within Iran's rather Byzantine form of government. And to some extent, it's just a matter of trying to figure out who the right people to talk are and who the people who are holding them are and how to gain leverage over those people who are holding the detainees.
Who is holding the detainees?
Well, to the best that we understand it, they're being held by the Revolutionary Guards, perhaps under the guidance of more hardline elements within the Revolutionary Guards, and perhaps also even more mysterious and unknown groups within Iran's political apparatus.
Let's learn more about the Revolutionary Guard and remind ourselves that this is a military unit formed in the late 70s to protect the then revolutionaries. It's separate from Iran's conventional military. Robin Wright writes in the Washington Post that the Guard has increased influence, become much more political, moved into business circles. You know, what do you think this story of the captured British sailors tells us about the Guard, if anything?
I don't think it's really related to that particular narrative. I think Robin's analysis was misguided. I know Rev Guards who are like, you know, travel agents. It's not about the Rev Guard. It's about the, you know, ideological hardliners. Here's the way I see the story and the way that, you know, the analysts that I talk to see the story. Iranian hardliners took a big gamble. They went to the UN Security Council resolution. They refused to budge on enrichment. They acted in a defiant way towards the West. They assured their counterparts they knew what they were doing. And they took this big gamble, and yet they could not get one single country on the Security Council to vote with them on the enrichment issue, on the sanctions issue. And the sanctions were upped, losing big, in order to detract attention from the story of Iran's failure, really, at the Security Council resolution. It's the fact that this whole strategy backfired. They fomented a crisis, much as they fomented a crisis to forestall criticism and instill unity in 1979, when the hardliners not only took the U.S. Diplomats and embassy employees in Tehran, but also, you know, continued to escalate and fan the flames of the incident for 444 days.
Well, and if that's the case, if you're thinking and the analyst thinking is correct, it's worked because, in fact, really, people have not been talking about the sanctions against Iran, about its enrichment program. They've been talking about the captured Brits.
Absolutely. And it also, the criticism that would have come about from the various reformist factions, from the moderates in the government, from those who've been arguing all along that it's foolish to defy the international community, they've been silenced to a certain extent. And that's changing a little bit, and I'll get back to that. They've been silenced to a certain extent by this crisis, because Iranians are intensely nationalistic, and they tend to come together at times of crisis.
Well, we understand. We saw the protests over the weekend, students throwing rocks, shouting, death to America, death to Britain. Now, you explained to us last week that there is a hardcore, hardline group of students as well. But so at least in the short term, there's been some unity over this issue. But you have said that the moderates also are speaking out. Tell us more about that.
These are the usual suspects. They come out to these kind of things all the time. They don't represent the mainstream of Iranian society at all. And I'll tell you where the mainstream of Iranian society was: the 100,000 who packed Azadi Stadium over the weekend for the big soccer match between the two main Tehran teams. There was no talk of this issue at that soccer match.
And you were starting to say, Borzu, you wanted to come back to the moderates' response.
Indeed. Over the past couple weeks, and it's been a very complicated time because of this, you've had the Persian New Year holidays, which is like spring break and Christmas break combined in Iran. And so no one's been around. The newspapers, the normal organs for the reformist movement, for the more moderate voices, don't publish around this time. And so you had not had those voices. They have started to emerge. There's been a lot of criticism in the past couple days we're picking up. It's not being reflected in the mass media, only because the mass media that is operating right now, the televisions and the radio stations, are in the hands of the hardliners. And it's going to be really interesting tomorrow to see what the more moderate reformist newspapers have to say when they start publishing again.
Well, one last question for you, Borzu, and it brings us back to the Revolutionary Guard. Are there any dots to connect here between the seizing of the British sailors and the seizing of several Iranian men in Iraq, the U.S. claiming that these were members of the Revolutionary Guard working deep inside Iraq, the Iranians saying that they are diplomats? They were supposed to be released 2 days before the British sailors were seized. Was there a quid pro quo here, or is this solely, as you said, to sort of throw out a distraction in light of what's been happening at the U.N. Security Council?
I think it's much broader than that, and I urge readers to check out the article that I'm writing tonight, and that might appear in tomorrow's paper about this subject. I think that there is definitely a connection between the broader pressure that the U.S. is bringing up on Iran. I've talked to some analysts who, know Iran really well, know the Gulf really well, and have said, basically Iran feels itself backed into a corner, and, instead of cowing in submission at the superior military power of the West, perhaps it's lashing out instead in hopes of preempting the what they feel is a unfair application of pressure and a possible future war on Iran, and to change the rules of the game a bit.
How do you see this playing out, Borzu?
There's a power struggle between the various factions in Iran, and one faction is trying to sabotage the authority and power of the other faction, so that, you had this pattern all week where whenever the foreign ministry folks would make a deal, try to get a compromise, you would have one of these tapes aired, and the British getting all upset and angry, not realizing perhaps that by getting upset and angry and, curtailing diplomatic ties, they were playing right into the hands of the extremists.
Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We'll link to your writing at our website, here-now.org, so people can keep abreast of it with you. Borzu, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure, Robin.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, Passover begins at sunset tonight, and during the Passover Seder, Orthodox Jews eat only the handmade, round, flat matzahs called shemura matzahs, or matzah for plural. John Kalish visited a bakery in Brooklyn devoted to making shemura matzahs. This time of year, it's a scene of controlled pandemonium.
Welcome to the Haredi Shemura Matzah Bakery in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, one of New York City's most religious Jewish neighborhoods. In a large, long room, a few dozen people are making the round, flat bread of affliction that Jews eat at the Passover Seder. The man in charge of this frenzied three-hour work session is Rabbi Yehuda Nathan, who also happens to be a computer programmer. His ultimate job is to make sure none of the dough starts fermenting and therefore turns into chametz, which Jews are forbidden to eat during the 8 days of Passover.
Chametz on Pesach is as bad as, if not worse than, poison.
It may be a stretch to equate fermented dough with poison, but to these ultra-Orthodox Jews, it's an article of faith. So Rabbi Nathan and two other taskmasters must make sure that, as prescribed by traditional Jewish law, no more than 18 minutes go by between the time the water and flour are mixed and the matzahs get baked.
That's the law, and that's it. You don't go through a red light because it's against the law. You don't wait over 18 minutes because that's the law. That's all.
40, 39, 38, 37.
Another rabbi holds a digital timer and warns the assembled matzah makers when the 18 minutes are up. To say that these Orthodox Jews are diligent about avoiding chametz is putting it mildly. These are people, after all, who've been known to brush every last crumb out of their pants pockets with a toothbrush before Passover in an effort to make their homes what one local rabbi has called a chametz-free zone. These matzah bakers keep the flour and water in separate little rooms that each have a window opening onto a small nook where a large stainless steel bowl is used to mix the dough.
Man opens that window over there, pours in a pre-measured amount of flour. He closes his window, then they'll open the window of the water room, and he'll stick his hand out and pour the water into the flour. And then you see the equivalent of a human mixmaster.
That human mixmaster is a strong young man wearing rubber gloves. He does some preliminary mixing with just his hands before handing the lump of dough off to one of two guys stationed at a small stainless steel table. Using car axles filled with cement, they pound the dough, roll it into long cylindrical strips, and deliver it to Mrs. Weber, the bakery's owner. Mrs. Weber has been likened to a military drill instructor, but the most impressive thing about her is that after chopping hockey puck-sized pieces of dough, she tosses them down a long, narrow table to the waiting matzo rollers. She does this with a flick of a wrist and without looking.
26.
Each matzah is rolled twice, a rough roll with a wooden rolling pin and a finer roll with a steel pin, before it's taken to another table where it's perforated. There, it's draped over long wooden poles and carried to a wood and coal-fired oven.
The commandment is to eat the matzahs, so we're improving the mitzvah, the commandment, by preparing it ourselves. Why should I outsource it when I can hold it for myself?
Nachum Cohen is an Orthodox Jew in Manhattan who has been making his own shmura matzah for years.
There is a feeling of holiness. You know, I'm saying to myself, I'm making these matzah for the commandment. So I'm singing to myself while I'm making them, and I'm being there for 3 hours. It's already a little hypnotic. It's a good feeling.
40, 13, 12, 11, 10... 9, 8, 7.
These round handmade shmura matzahs really are the antithesis of square machine-made store-bought matzahs. They're thinner, they taste a lot more earthy, and look kind of ancient. Nachum Cohen says the people who come to his Seder relish even the overdone pieces.
I love the burnt parts. Everyone in the family wants the burnt parts. Even though the fireman is trying to pull the matzahs out, they shouldn't be burnt. All the kids and everyone in the guests, they all know they all want the burnt parts.
This shmura matzah is a bit pricey. It sells for $20 a pound. But to those who take seriously the celebration of the Jews' exodus from Egypt all those years ago, it's certainly worth the time and cost.
John Kalish in Brooklyn, New York. Happy Passover if you're celebrating. This is Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Native American performers face some mighty challenges. They have to fight stereotypes, often represent a variety of sovereign nations, and mix the traditional with the modern. Keeping the Fire in Dark Moon Times is a program of stories, music, and dance that tours the schools, museums, and reservations from Washington, D.C. to Alaska and Hawaii. They recently stopped at the Peabody Essex Museum here in Massachusetts. This is an exchange of cultures from the Wampanoag of Massachusetts to the Inupiaq of Alaska. It's funded by the federal program Echo Arts, and joining us with more, two of the performers. Hi'ilani Shibata, welcome.
Aloha.
And Stephen Blanchett, welcome to you as well.
Waka.
And that gives us an idea of what we're about to encounter, different languages perhaps. Hi'ilani, you said hello in Hawaiian, I could understand, but you're both Hawaiian and Japanese.
Yes, I'm half Hawaiian, half Japanese.
You know, we tend to forget that Hawaiians are Native Americans.
At times, actually, when people come to Hawaii, they forget that they're actually in the United States.
How did several different cultures, regions, and worldviews come together in this piece? Is the idea to blend the different cultures or keep them separate and let them each step forward and have their moment?
Everybody's showcased, but it doesn't seem like it's not connected. So it's like the ocean and the waves just rolling in and out.
A nice image. Well, Stephen Blanchett, explain to me your background.
Well, I'm Yupik and not Inupiaq. There are two different groups in Alaska. But they're both from the Inuit language family, so we can understand each other with the root words. Inuit people span across from Russia, across Alaska, all across Canada into Greenland. And when I'm in Greenland or Russia, Canada, I can sit down and talk with the Inuits there.
Would you mind speaking to me more in the language?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful sound.
Well, what I said to you when you introduced me, I said, Hwaka. Hwaka means hello. How are you? That's my name. I am from the village of Bethel.
You're also African-American, so
right.
Somehow someone met someone, and you are also mixed race. And as luck would have it, a record and film producer. Let's hear a bit from the tour. This is you singing. We'll listen to a little. Can you tell us what you're singing about here?
The song is called Ayagat Nam Kanaya Yuga, and that means let me take you to places where we hunt, let me take you to places where we pick the berries from the tundra. And in the drum solo, they're cutting the fish, and it's a herring fish, and braiding it together with grass and placing them up into the fish racks to dry in the sun.
Hi'ilani, Keeping the Fire, the whole program, is about ancestral stories, the symbolism of the moon. What does it mean to say dark moon times?
Anything, any trials or tribulations, you always keep that fire burning. It's actually in a relationship to Jack Dalton, the storyteller, a Yupik Alaskan storyteller. We call the story of keeping the fire burning when there's darkness. That was the most important part of their tribe.
I mean, there's even a song called Unuranga Tandritanga, which means the moon is up above and our ancestors are up in it swinging back and forth and shining down the moonlight around us to remind us the beauty that we have in these dark times. And it's referring to when the Westerners came, Ashanaks, we call them Ashanaks, the outside people, came in and things started to change and there was sickness and all these things. And it seemed like there's just darkness around us. And the moon was there to remind us that good times are going to come to us soon.
Stephen, you also throat sing in your performance. And we know, you know, that that tradition still exists in parts of Asia, the Tuvian throat singers. How do you think it got to Alaska? Or maybe it went the other way?
Actually, it's kind of unique because the Inuit throat singing, there's a group of people that do it in Russia. It skips over Alaska. And a huge group in Canada that do it. And then skips Greenland. So these Inuit, all these, like the us four different main Inuit groups, it skips over. But in my travels and performance, you know, I've gained friendships and with different performers throughout the Arctic region, and they influence us musically in our group. So we started to take on and learn those styles of throat singing, but they're not specific to my region, my area. But we're taught by all these Inuits.
Oh, can you sing some of that for us now?
Sure. This style here is more Tuvan style, and it's just kind of a little bit like people who understand a didgeridoo, the Australian instrument. It's kind of the same aspect. It's reverberating on these vibrations in your throat,
mm-hmm.
Causing this sound.
that's wonderful. And we should, for our listeners, you hardly moved. That was all that air was down in your throat.
Yeah, just take a deep breath and let it out very slowly.
Wow. Well, you know, I just want to ask both of you, Hilani, also chime in. You know, Native American identity is a tough topic for some. We watched as the Cherokee tribes here, in the mainland, their highest court was trying to decide whether to give citizenship to the so-called freedmen. These were the descendants of former slaves who'd been owned by the Cherokees. That was overturned by a petition of the Cherokee people. They wanted to keep it just Cherokees by blood, you know, who could be called a Native American. Here you are both mixed race and yet really holding on to and trying to pass along the traditions of your either Native Hawaiian or Native Yupik peoples. I mean, what does it mean to be a Native person now?
I grew up that way, grew up Yupik, grew up fishing, hunting, that whole subsistence lifestyle, the ceremonies, everything that goes along with being Yupik. And, you know, my African-American side, my dad was just as strong as and as an influence on me. He was a African Methodist Episcopal Zion minister, preacher.
Wow.
So he would make sure that I would head to Philadelphia and North Carolina to visit my family ever since I was a little kid out there, you know. And I would go from this little village and head into Philadelphia, this huge, huge city to me. So both of those influences were very profound on shaping who I am.
It's really interesting to hear this because we get this question a lot about, you know, are you only identifying with your Native side? And we don't. We identify with all of our sides.
But for the purposes of the program that you're doing, Keeping the Fire in Dark Moon Times, it is keeping the fire alive of your Native peoples.
And it's actually keeping the fire alive in
every culture. Every person has a fire inside them that their ancestors put in there, and that we are all perfect creations of our ancestors.
That's Stephen Blanchett. He and Hi'ilani Shabata are two of the many performers in Keeping the Fire in Dark Moon Times. To find out more about their tour, go to our website here-now.org. Thank you both so much for coming by to tell us about it.
Mahalo.
Oiana.
And we're going to leave you with some music from cellist Don Avery of Mohawk Heritage. It's called Sweat Lodge. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.